You're listening to The Cultural Hall with your hosts, Richie T. Stedman and Ashley Garvey Smith. It's a show about Mormon stuff.
Nephi! Ella! Samuel! Give us land to live righteously!
That's right, it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode 50. And for those of you that have been following us for a while, you thought that this episode was going to be me, Richie T, and his mom interviewing my mom here in the Cultural Hall. That we thought better of our relationship and decided that we should not have my mom do an episode of the Cultural Hall. Well, so
did you just start talking about it and then you're like, maybe not?
Yeah, my mom and I have decided to
part ways
in discussing religion.
Mom is your mom not LDS?
No, she's not.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
That was kind of like
that was where the episode was going to go to.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
And So I'll leave it at that. My mom, who is an amazing person, who I've learned tremendous amount of life lessons from. In fact, the very reason for this podcast is a great deal due to my mom. But she won't be here on an episode. So with that being said, we'll move past it.
Speaking of your mom, I saw your mom last week at a wedding. Your little brother got married.
I know.
We got to talk about that a little bit.
Do we?
Is that okay?
No one knows my little brother.
But it was fun.
But here's what was cool. Here's what was cool and also what I don't get. People get really stressed about weddings. And I don't know how you, Rob, being a DJ, a wedding DJ, deal with it.
Yeah.
Because apparently I made a lot of people mad at my brother's wedding.
No.
Really? I haven't heard about that.
Because
I said, shut
up. I said, I called her Lauren.
Yes.
And her name is Lauren.
I've had that problem before.
Oh, come on. Really?
Apparently to the point of extreme upsettedness.
Like, 'cause you did it more than once.
This is her day. Yeah. I can't believe. You know what? Truthfully, I didn't know her name was Lauren and not Lauren, nor do I think it matters.
But
no, it's not like you called her Cindy.
Yeah, it's not like I called her, you know, Jane and her name was Cindy or something like that.
Well, let me tell you, the people get, it's their day and one little thing can maybe disrupt. It's up to the personality of the people.
My
and
day
I think
must
a lot
be
of people
perfect.
That people got mad at you was probably not her, but the people surrounding her.
Sure.
I did a wedding. The guy's name was, why am I forgetting his
Moroni Ha.
It was Moroni Ha and.
That would be hot.
No,
not
it
really.
It could be.
No, never.
Moroni Ha could never be a hot name.
Moroni Ha.
Close your eyes for a minute.
They're closed.
I want you to imagine a little dark. Maybe he's tan. Maybe he's from another country. Maybe down south, right? He's got long hair.
Oh, no.
He's got short hair.
Oh.
High and tight.
Oh, okay.
And a little bit of
can it be a little curly?
Yeah, a little curly. A little wavy, maybe.
Oh,
a little curly.
Right, yeah.
He's got blue eyes, a little dark skin.
Oh my
right?
goodness.
He's tone.
Oh dear.
And he's like he's 6'6"?
So no, that's not too tall.
He's 6'4"?
Yeah.
He's 6'2?
Yeah, 6'2".
Blue eyes. And he's like, "Hello, Brittany. I also am anxiously, but my blog is Anxious Brown Virgin." blogspot.com and he says, "My name is Moroni Ha, and I would like to take you to the temple." You can't tell me that you wouldn't be all over that.
Moroni Ha.
You would.
Maybe.
Just anyone that would be willing to take you about at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, no.
Are you going to the temple? Yeah.
Not true, actually. So something has happened that I didn't expect. I didn't anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
I blog all the time about how I'm single and kind of lament that fact. And then on the radio, on our podcast, I lament that I'm single.
Uh-huh.
And, you
You've
know.
You met someone.
No, not at all.
And he's the greatest thing ever.
No, not even close.
And it wasn't someone that you thought you would date.
Oh, shut up.
The exact opposite of what you thought you wanted. It, but truly.
The best thing that I never knew I needed.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. No, but. People have started taking me up on this offer of like, "Hey guys, where are you at?" You know, and
where are you at? What do you mean?
Like,
you're lamenting where are all the guys
yes,
at? And,
yes,
and the guys are saying, "Oh, here I am."
Yes, and okay. And there are men who, you know, very
attractive,
no,
wealthy.
Well, no, and this is where I feel
lonely.
I
desperate,
feel bad. I'm gonna
pathetic,
say,
you're
okay,
gonna come off. You're not
okay.
gonna win here.
I'm gonna say. I'm just gonna say it. All right. While the attention I have received has been extremely flattering and very much appreciated, as of yet, it hasn't come from anyone that I would consider
attractive.
Someone who I would date.
Why?
Well, part
age.
Age.
Too
age,
old or too young?
Too old.
Too old.
Too old.
I thought about the young ones. I thought the young ones were picking
up. How old?
Up
how old are we talking? What's too old?
You know, a lot of it is.
Answer the question. Don't a lot of it this me. Tell me how old is too old.
No, but I can't put a number on it because I've met people who are like 35 who I click with, and then there are people who I've met who
40.
Are.
40. I'm 40. Am I too old?
No, that's too
doesn't
old.
Doesn't matter.
That's too
doesn't
old.
Matter
yeah,
it doesn't
matter
if I'm the youngest acting 40-year-old.
If you okay, so you both, Rob and Richie, you know that I don't look my age. Right. I look relatively 50. Young. Yes. I'm going to punch you in the face. No, but most people still think I'm in my early 20s.
Yeah.
So if I'm dating a man who looks...
Because you're not through with college. That's
yeah,
part of it.
Yeah, it's true. God's preserving me until I get married, I'm telling you. If I'm dating a guy who is looking his age, then I start to feel like I'm dating my father. This is why I tend to date guys who are younger because mm-hmm. we look similar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and so I'm sorry, but if you're gut, so you know,
so these guys coming out of the woodwork look old. What else? What else is their deal?
No, a lot of it is just physical. I'm as superficial as anybody else, and I think that it's important to be
but
physically
fat?
Attracted.
Is that what we're saying?
We asked her this question the other night. We had a round table of guys, and we were like, so what are you looking for? She's like, oh, I know it when I see it.
Yeah, there's. I can't give
not
you.
Not fat? It's not fat?
You know, I'm relatively svelte. I'm a slighter individual, and uh-huh. so I think I prefer... You know, someone who's fit too.
Because you can lose weight, you know that, right?
Right. No, okay. I know. I'd take a good personality over a good body, sure. but the thing is, I want to be sexually attracted to whoever I end up with because I want to be able to engage in
that's
such
ridiculous.
Activities. You know, but do you understand? Like, I don't want my husband coming to me and being like, "Hey, hey, hey," and me being like, "Oh, wifely duties." Okay, I want to be like, "Yes." Again, for the fifth time today.
I think a lot of people are in that boat, so we'd just say it just comes down to attraction.
Yes. I don't think I'm a bad person by yeah. saying that I want to be attracted to that person. And right. so thank you for all those who are
for all those
who,
suitors.
For yes, who have gone out there and put themselves on the line and don't stop.
You at least give them a date?
I have with some of them.
Yeah.
I dignified a couple of them.
Yeah, I did.
Was it all right?
They were perfectly nice.
Just not it.
Nope.
That's all right, though, because at least you're like, okay, maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah.
Willing to give it a shot.
Certainly. Certainly.
I finally thought of that name. I mispronounced the name. His name was Reagan. I said Regan, but I was once. It was during his introduction.
So.
Back to that last story.
Perfect.
We've tangented so far now. I don't even think it matters anymore.
I don't know.
I don't know. But you've got this. So instead of your mom now, we're going to
do. So now we're going to be talking to Bobby Teal.
No.
Do you guys know who that is?
No. Tell us about Bobby.
Do you guys know who the Krays are?
No.
Okay. Do you guys know what mafia is?
Like the mafia?
La Cosa Nostra?
Yeah. She didn't have a job. She was part of the mafia.
I'm going to make him an offer I can't refuse.
Right. That's this guy.
Did they make a movie about him called Mormons and the Mafia?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Mobsters and Mormons?
Mobsters and Mormons, whatever
no,
that movie was.
That is not what this interview is
with the guy from
the
TV show Studs?
Stop.
No. So second and third block, we talked to this guy who turned in the mafia over in England and
really?
Had to go in hiding for 40 years.
Wow, this didn't, sounds really exciting.
Didn't get to see his kid, his daughter, didn't get to see his brothers. Whole new life, left it behind. And just a couple of years ago, someone from his family tried to get in touch with him and everything came washing back.
Well, this how does awesome. He know he's safe now?
You have to listen. That's coming up in what the second tease. And the third block Woo. Here of the Cultural Hall.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5500. 576 to book your shoot today.
All right, it's back in the second block, and joining us here is Bobby Teal.
Right.
Now, we tease this, and you might think, I don't know who that is.
Right.
And if we say the name The Krays, you probably don't, you know, maybe know who that is.
Probably not.
Or if we say The Firm, for example, you probably don't know what that is. By the time the second and third block have ended, we hope to answer all of those questions.
That's right.
And I think this is going to be an awesome story. So thank you for being here with us, Bobby.
You're
thank
welcome.
You so much.
Brother
Teal is in my ward.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I heard about
tell
this.
Tell us how it came to be that Bobby's here in the Cultural Hall with
well,
us.
Well, So it was a fast and testimony meeting at church, and Brother Teal got up and bore his testimony. And I'm not an emotional person. You know this about me.
Yeah, I know. You're heartless.
Yes, I have a very cold heart. Yeah. And not emotional at all. But after Brother Teal bore his testimony, I was in tears, like looking for tissues, trying to wipe my eyes. It was so touching. And he was talking about, which we'll discuss, he was talking about reconnecting with a daughter he hadn't even seen in over 40 years.
Absolutely.
And it was so touching. And so I started asking my husband questions, and my husband told me, hey, this guy has an amazing story. So we actually read about the story online before we approached you and asked you about it. So it was really fascinating. I posted a little snippet on Facebook a few weeks ago, and it was, yeah, so we've got an interesting story to talk about.
So let's get right into it. Bobby, born and raised in England, correct?
Yes, London.
London.
Yes.
And let's just dive in. So wherever you feel necessary to start, but I'd like to go way back at the beginning. Not kind of a rough character, it seems like, from everything I've read about
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, absolutely. We, you know, born and bred in the heart of London, brought up, and not too far from us lived a family called the Krays, and spelled with a K, K-R-A-Y. And they were family friends as well as anything else. And I was sort of in my teens, and that was when I met them, but they were always dropping around because we had nightclubs in London, and they also had nightclubs, and I knew very little about them, but I knew that they were very highly feared and respected. So that's as far as I got, as far at the early stages. Then I got to be a very close friend of one of them, Reggie Cray. Ronnie was psychopathic, schizophrenic. These are all things that anyone doing a little bit of research would discover, but turned out to be a terrible killer and a number of other things. But so the area that I was in was I was a friend of Reggie. Reggie and I used to be just very close friends. And
like go out to dinner kind of friends, or like,
no,
hey, Bobby, I need you to take care of this kind of friend?
No, it was always, you know, you go to the pub, or you go out with a couple of what they call birds in England. It's chicks or females.
Dames, skirts.
Girls, yes. Yeah. Okay. So this was a common thing. And so that's how I met them, through my two brothers who knew them before I did. In fact, they knew them for about 5 years, and I only knew them for about 1 year. So, they seem to be just villains. A villain terminology in London is just a person who goes out, makes a living, whatever way they do it. But they're not, in my terminology anyway, they're not violent to the degree that I found out these people were. So it was pretty heavy when I discovered that, in fact, they enjoyed killing people and killed a few people.
How did you find that out? Was it like, well, hey, Reggie, have you ever killed anyone? No, yes, as a matter of fact. I mean,
No, they don't run that.
I can't imagine that they would talk about it that way.
The idea was that they would phone and we'd go over to a particular pub for a party or something like this. And they'd phone this night to go over to a particular pub in the East End, which was a common pub where we all used to meet. And we got there, and when we got there, everyone was leaving, and they jumped in. Reggie jumped into our car, and he said, quick, get out off the manor. Off the manor means get out this area quickly. Ronnie has just shot Cornell.
Oh, jeez.
And it was like, I said, what? And anyway, so we headed out of the area and into a place, area called Walthamstow, and everyone was on the radio, listening to the radio reports that there'd been a shooting in the East End, and George Cornell had been shot dead. So it goes on and on, and I can tell you, you know, in the book, it gives more details. But
and the name of the book is Bringing Down the Krays.
Yeah.
Did you have someone ghostwrite this, or did you actually write it?
No, we had Claire Campbell, our ghostwriter, doing most of the writing, well, all of the writing. And I would just send my excerpts in, and she would take that off. I was still in Cedar Hills doing a lot until I recently went to London for promotion of the book, and it came out on the 24th of June.
to give people kind of an idea, I'm looking up, I just did a wiki search on the craze, because I think, you know, probably in London it's pretty well known, but, you know, here for me in Utah, born and raised in Utah, I don't really know much about the craze. Kind of sounded familiar, and I know there was a movie about 20 years ago or so.
Yeah,
about
I think there's been a couple of movies, but, you know.
But to give you an idea, so this is from the Wikipedia article. It says, the craze were involved in armed robberies, arson, protection rackets, violent assaults, including torture and murders of Jack the Hat McVitie and George Cornell. They were West End nightclub owners, like you mentioned. And they also mixed with prominent entertainers, including Diana Doors, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, and other politicians. It says that in their own right, they themselves became famous and were interviewed on television and photographed by David Bailey. So kind of like how we think of some of the mafia families here in the United States. That's what these guys were.
Absolutely.
Big power player.
Absolutely. And they mixed with them. And the three of us, our three, my two brothers, Elfie and David, and myself, would be on the same page, in the same loop as them in terms of the entertainment side of it. Mm-hmm. We weren't in the other side of it, but we were certainly that part, because it was the time of the early stage of the Beatles, and you had a lot of stuff going on. So it was all the raving 60s, and we became family friends of theirs because they were very involved with the same business in terms of the nightclub side of it. And from then on, I had a small business in a place called the Isle of Wight, and then things started to develop. When the murder took place, they kind of hooked us into that. And as soon as they hooked us in, they moved into David's flat in London and demanded to stay there for a couple of weeks. And at this stage, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is not going to happen on my watch. I realized...
Or this certainly can't end well, it seems.
Right.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it couldn't. I thought there was about at least six times that they planned to kill me, but not for the reason I thought. It was more for a jealousy. Ronnie and Reggie are twins, identical twins, so they were bonded to each other. So I became very friendly with Reggie, and of course Ronnie was fuming. Ronnie was the psychotic, certified schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that each time they tried to make a move on me, that I had to really, really watch it. And at this stage, when they'd moved into my brother's flat and made a couple of terrible moves in the flat on one of my little brothers, I decided I'm going to Scotland Yard. I go to Scotland Yard. I managed to get out of the flat because everyone was being watched in the flat. The whole firm was in the flat. Don't forget, imagine this, a small two-bedroom flat, which is very small, and there was about 10 different people there, all milling around, coming and going, all carrying guns. And at the time, I did carry a gun as well. So I got in touch with Scotland Yard, explained that to them. They said, I said, now you're going in. This is where they are. You've got to go in because my family is terrified. My family being Christine, my sister-in-law, my brother David, Alfie, Paul, and you know, the group of us. And I said, and they won't leave. They're demanding to stay there. So the highest man in Scotland Yard by the name of Tommy Butler said to me, well, no, we're not going in. I said, well, what do you mean you're not going in? He said, well, we want you to go back in there. And now the whole thing starts to change. So now I'm what they call in London a grass informer or
a rat. Yeah.
And Scotland Yard want me to get them all the information. So I continue to get this information for them. But what I couldn't believe is that as soon as I was giving them information, the information was coming back, because Scotland Yard at the time was extremely crooked. And there were people who were on the craze payroll. And the craze made everyone clear that anyone who tried anything, they would know instantly. Well, imagine getting back and sitting in amongst them, and then someone looking in the door and saying, Phillips has been in touch, because I used the code name Phillips.
Where did you get to come up with that?
Yeah, I did. Tommy Butler said, pick a name, and I had a great friend, it was a very dear friend of mine, by the name of Phil. So I said, we'll take that, Phillips. And anyway, he gave me my handler or contact, which was a person by the name of Joe Pogue. All this is in the book. Mm-hmm. But so now I'm going back in there. It's the whole ground rules have changed. I'm thinking I'm going in and the cavalry is going to come in and everything's going to be okay. And instead, it didn't happen. a ton of other stuff happened after that, and it was just a question now of me trying to survive and at the same time feed the information. These were the people who I was up against. Why I left England in 69. I was up against Scotland Yard because I didn't trust them. I was up against the Krays because I knew they'd kill me in a second, and they tried. And my own family, who none of them knew what I was doing, what I was actually, my activities.
You couldn't tell anyone that you were being an informant.
Couldn't tell a soul. No. And Scotland Yard said, don't tell a soul, and we'll handle it, and we'll get you out of it, and all that. And, of course, a lot of stuff they did was terrible and diabolical to my family. So anyway, I could go on this one and basically lay out the book, and you're going to get too fascinated by it because it does go very deep. Mm-hmm. It goes very deep. But if I jump a little bit and come to the fact that when I left England, I got out of England and I was out of, went into Canada.
Wait, before we get there, okay. I want to ask a couple questions too.
Fire.
Right. You said that you knew that they were trying to kill you.
Yes.
How did they try to kill you, or how did you know? And tell me a little bit about that, because I've never had anyone who's really tried to kill
right.
me before.
Okay,
sure.
Okay. Well, first of all, I knew their methods of operation, their MO, if you want. And I knew how they would actually kill me.
How would they do it?
Well, one of his favorites, apart from shooting someone in the head, which they had done.
That's a good way.
Yeah, but no, he would get close to you, and then he would kind of strangle you. He'd bring his arm up, strangle you, so you passed out. Then he'd break your neck, and then the body was gone. And they did that to a few people, but so each time there was a move like that, they would also forget things. They'd send me out to kill someone. And I had no intentions on the planet of ever pulling it off. But they would say, go down and do this person. And I'd say, okay, yeah, okay. And they'd send me with someone else. And, of course, the both of us had no intentions. And we'd go back and say, we couldn't find the person. The next day you'd say, well, do you want us to go? And they'd say, oh, no, forget that one. So it was all spur of the moment. A lot of the stuff was spur of the moment. So Ronnie would stand at the bar and look at me. And then he'd say, can you drive Reggie somewhere on a meet. It was always a meet, they call it, like a meeting with someone. Mm-hmm. You didn't ever know who the people were. It was sometimes it was police from Scotland Yard. Sometimes it was to pick up money from someone else. So, and one occasion I was asked to do that, and I thought, well, they've set up something, and I'm not supposed to come back, so I'll never be seen again. Don't forget, I'm 20-odd, you know. I'm
right.
Thinking, you know, I know everything anyway. So.
Sure, sure. We all do when we're in our early 20s.
So, I drive Reggie with me, and I'm thinking, I wonder if he's carrying a gun. But anyway, he says, drive here, there, and he's telling me, it's at night. And we drive down this street that's all blacked out. And I'd heard one of the firms say, I've done it, all the streets blacked out. This was way before I left. And as I left, it was the strangest feeling because I looked around at the firm and there was a lot of members there. There must have been about 20 or 30 people who were part of the firm, not directly in a circle, mm-hmm. and certainly not as close as I was because I was family in a circle. So I looked around and I heard, it's going to sound off the wall, but I heard a clear voice that they were saying to me goodbye. In other words, they all knew I wasn't coming back. Well, I got to this street with Reggie, and he was, he said, stop here and turn the engine off and turn your lights off.
Jeez.
And so, and it's a black, dead-end street. I can't even see the end
right.
of this street. It's totally blacked out. And I'm thinking, so I do what he said, and then he gets out of the car, and now I can't see him. And I'm thinking, well, this is it. It's time to leave the planet. And he... Then something said, honestly, a way it said, start the van. It was a van. It was my van. It started up and turn around, because if I'd have gone ahead, I couldn't see anything, even with the lights on. So I did. I started up and I turned around. Well, it must have spooked Reggie because he got back in the van and he was fuming. And he said, go ahead. Okay, drive. And I thought as he sat in the van that he was going to pull a gun, but he didn't. And we drove back, and as I walked into the big hall that all these firm were, they all looked at me like,
what are you doing here?
What are you doing? And especially Ronnie. And then Reggie walked over to Ronnie, and I left, and I didn't.
And they never said anything? You never talked about it or anything?
No.
So here's my question. At this time, are you married?
I had been married. I'd been married for 1 year or just over a year.
Okay.
Okay. And even your wife didn't know about what was going on?
No, but then I'd got divorced.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so. And it's strange because I've got to jump a little bit because I met her after 40 odd years. She demanded her daughter let her, because her daughter and her were in a bit of a battle. But she, her daughter Tracy said, no, you're not seeing him. You're not allowed to see him. She did. So I said, oh, Trace, you got it. No, no, I don't care. She's treated me badly and told me all lies about you. And it was all lies.
And this is your daughter.
This is my daughter, Tracy. It was 48, 47, something like that. Anyway, but eventually Pat, was my ex-wife, meets me and she hugs me. And it was the strangest thing I've ever felt.
After 40 years?
After 40
I'm
odd
sure.
years. And 40 odd years of all kinds of rumors. I mean, massive rumors all about me. I was buried under the bridge in, you know, he's dead, and everyone assumed that I was dead.
Right.
No question about that. And so, and then there was rumors that, no, he's not dead. He's alive and working for the CIA, and he's running guns from Ireland to France and all weird stuff.
That's pretty cool
That made
stuff.
You seem really exciting.
It made
a
it
lot
sound
more
like
exciting.
I was like a James Bond character, and it was so ridiculous because at the time I was building houses in Canada. So...
Did you follow that stuff? I mean, that's a time before the internet, so it wasn't as easy as just sitting down and Googling, but were you able to get stories, you know, from the newspaper over in England and stuff like that?
Not even a fraction. I was shocked when I got back to England. I mean,
about all the legends
about you. About the whole thing, that they were built these people up, and when they got sentenced to 30 years, they started an industry, and they used to charge people who wanted to go and to see them.
These are the Krays?
The Krays. And Charlie, there's three brothers, but the twins, they'd say, well, this is the fee that you will pay to come and see us. And
In prison.
So they'd have the money sent, and then they made films, and they made all kinds
of... So it bothered you that these criminals were being glorified when you knew the horrible things that they were doing?
Absolutely.
And that one of them was certifiably crazy as well.
Yeah, well, the other one wasn't far off, but they were both in the same thing. Absolutely shocked. And I said, well, I can't believe this. I risked my life to save the government millions, untold millions, by working for them. They had no intentions of going after them at that time. It took 2 years after that and another few murders before they go after the Krays, because the government didn't want them attacking the Krays at the time, because it was a very crucial political time. So I was in the way.
Right.
And I knew it. I realized it after, and I said, and I knew it by simply the fact that Scotland Yard asked me after the thing that if I'd go into Ireland. Ireland was the hottest bed. If every 10 people going into Ireland, there was about 3 coming out.
Jeez.
And they wanted me in there. And a friend of mine in Scotland Yard said, don't you dare go in there. Get out the country and get out fast. And I refused to go into Ireland. Then they pulled. I had 2 armed guards with me. Mm-hmm. This was now running forward in 69 when the actual arrest and they got sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled the armed guards. So now I'm an open target.
Right.
I'm thinking,
you're just by yourself.
I've got the Krays, I've got the Scotland Yard, and I've got the my family. So that was it. I was just had to make a move. And if I hadn't have, when I look back on it, I see a lot of the stuff you're asking me, sure. I only knew when I went back 2 years ago.
Hmm.
I knew nothing before that. So when they're telling me all this stuff, my brothers, and the news, what was going on, I'm going, what? They said, yeah. And my daughter, Paula, in Canada, bought me a book one Christmas called Defining Moments in History. And it had all of it, like it had the Kennedy assassination. So I open the book. It's a huge book. And in its...
And at this time, your daughter doesn't know about what...
Doesn't have a clue. This is a few years ago.
Okay.
This is, I mean, 2 years ago, I connected with a family in England for the first time in 40-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 years before that...
So this is just her thinking about
thoughtful gift. No, she says, there's a book, and you'll like it, Dad. It's good. And I open it Christmas, and I can't believe it, because a few pages, I see crime, and then I see Reggie's coughing, my best friend at the time,
mm-hmm.
in the Hearst. And it's, I think it's in one of these books. Anyway... So I stood up, I said, see this person in this coffin, like it's a horse-drawn thing, a huge funeral. It mm-hmm. was like as big as Churchill. His Ronnie's was bigger than Churchill's funeral.
Wow.
Winston Churchill, for those yeah. who right. didn't put the connection.
Sorry. But so I opened it. I said, do you know, I said, this person was once my best friend. And they said, what? Jason, Paula, and Philip are there, my children's name.
And then did you say, oops, I better not say anymore.
I did. I did. I felt bad. And they said, oh, did you ever kill anyone? I said, no. In fact, I saved a few people's lives. But anyway, it's
but these guys are heroes, quote unquote, heroes, you know, being glorified
for the young kids, the young criminals. Right. They're going, well, they're worshiping them. They want everything about them. I mean, there's a whole following in as we sit here in London, in England, and tons of people in the U.S. and Canada know clearly about them. Hmm. You know, I've mentioned their name, and they, oh, I know them. To keep away from them, I say, well, they are in prison or dead or whatever, you know.
But, right.
So coming back in the third block, I want to talk about how it was that they finally got sent to prison. And then we got a lot of catching up to do, because we're talking 1969 and to present. How it went while you were gone away, kind of in hiding, and what prompted you to come back and write the book. So that's all going to come up here in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's the third block of the Culture Hall, and we're sitting down with Bobby Teal, who wrote the book Bringing Down the Craze. And we're about to the point now where it's actually they get arrested. They get put away for 30 years for killing people. What was your involvement with that? And then I want to get in with all the time since 1969, what you've been doing, how you found the gospel and everything like that. So let's just pick up right there.
Okay, well, I hope you got a couple of days, because it's going to be very condensed. So they get sentenced, and as I was saying about me supposed to go into Ireland, I refused that. Then I realized, well, I've got no protection now. My family now know, because at the time of the trial, I actually came forward, and they said, well, the prosecution or their defense came at me heavily and said, well, you've never mentioned this before. And I said, oh, yeah, I did. I mentioned it right after the Cornell murder.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I spoke to Tommy Butler, Scotland Yard, and there's a whole transcript on that confirming everything, because our ghostwriter, researched everything for archives to confirm every word we were saying was, in fact, the truth.
Right.
So as soon as they got their sentence, I decided I had to leave England, and I did. It was in 1969. I got into Gibraltar. I hitchhiked from England. I had very little money, and I got into Gibraltar just after John Lennon and Yoko Ono got married there. And I met a girl there who was on a sabbatical for her nursing from Edmonton, Canada. So we traveled into Africa, then sailed the Atlantic, three of us, from Las Palmas to Antigua in 23 days, 3,000 miles.
Oh my gosh.
On a catamaran, a 40-foot, and that was an episode in itself, because it was his eyesight was bad, the person who owned the boat. So he asked me to navigate, and I'd never navigated around a corner, let alone across the Atlantic Ocean.
Tell me if you see anything, Bobby. Yeah.
And there was a ton of stuff on. I mean, there was whales as big as the 40-footer, bigger, and they would follow us for days, and a whole area of tremendous experience.
Do you feel like you were blessed, watched over, and protected?
I know I was. I was protected right from the way, way back. I remember a lot of stuff that indicated to me that it was something way more powerful than me, knew exactly what was going on, because it was so intuitive. It was so,
right.
Like everything that I did to dodge being killed wasn't my design. Anyway, my prayers, I was always praying, and it was always about, I called God, our Father, I called Mr. Wonderful, and my ex-wife will confirm this, that's in Canada, not the mm-hmm. other one.
Right.
I've got a list. Oh my God. Anyway, so and I would pray, and anyway, we made it across the Atlantic, which was a feat in itself.
Addressed as Mr. Wonderful, really though? Mr. Wonderful, and then
Well, I would say, okay, you're guiding us, and this is my private prayer, and I've never told anyone this before. And so that was my so we got married in Edmonton, Canada, in 70, January 70. And
this woman who you'd been traveling with.
The nurse, mm-hmm. Eileen is her name, and she's a nurse to this day, working in Victoria, Canada. And my children living in Victoria, and my grandchildren, stuff like this. But and so we made it across. And when we got into Canada, I think we were I was in Canada for 7 years. It was 1977. I was building houses. I'd got into construction trade. And
is that essentially? It's like you get to redesign how your life was, right?
Absolutely. Because first of all, I thought that I wouldn't get into Canada. And then all of a sudden they must have got in touch with Scotland Yard and said, well, he's arrived. What do we do? And they said, well, open the doors. And they did. They were amazingly gracious, the Canadian government and the U.S. government for that matter. But anyway, 7 years and three children later, I get a knock on the door. I'm struggling. At the time, I was drinking heavy.
Drink of choice? Just curious. What's your drink of choice?
Well, I used to drink gin and tonic, which I was kind of brought up on,
yeah.
In London. But it was rum and coke.
Anything.
Yeah, I was drinking, but beer, a lot of beer. And on construction sites, you'd leave at 4 o'clock. Or if it was raining at 2, you'd be into the pub and everyone would be praying for rain.
Right.
So alcohol was a common thing, and it was a battle for me. So... And I was praying so hard. I had got some guidance, and it was so amazing because I'd built a garage while I was building this house, and it was in a place called Stettler, just outside of Stettler, actually. And a knock on the door, and it was so remarkable because it was two missionaries from the church, and they started talking, and I thought, oh my God, this is what I've been praying for all this time. And all their principles were so dead on with what I felt that I thought, well, within a month or something, the whole family was baptized. They called us the Golden Family. And I still to this day remember Elder Cotter and Elder Venerable. I've never seen them again, but that was where we got the first introduction to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And from then on, over the years, I was kind of semi-active, solidly active for the first 5 years. It was powerful. Alcohol went down, you know, no booze, no tea, all the stuff.
Right.
You know, I was...
Those vices, hard to change.
Yeah, very, very hard, but it wasn't so hard because in the church, there's such a powerful support system. I mean, mm-hmm. and they're very gentle about it. They're never sort of like... People may, who are not active, think, well, they did this to me. But if they look deeper, they can find that it's so forgiving. And it was to me. And I thought, and I always thought then, I thought, well, if they only knew who I was, they'd probably throw me out the door. But then I learned over the years, as the 30-odd years went, 37 or something it may be now, I thought, well, I've watched videos of the mafia being in the church, and one working in the temple, and all this stuff. So I thought, well, my situation is not as bad, and I'm carrying it like this. Believe it or not, Satan plays magnificent roles, mm-hmm. diabolical but magnificent, to convince you that you're beyond that.
Right.
I mean, why bother going back? Why bother even joining? Because if they knew, blah, 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 blah. And if you override that and think, well, you're one of God's children, it's impossible for you not to progress and be guided by the Spirit. And that's exactly what I did. It was a battle, I have to admit, over the years. It was like on and off. But I always struggled to stay. And then I wanted to go to the temple. And this wasn't long ago. This was must have been about 6 or 7 years ago. And it was a battle to get to the temple, the Seattle temple from Victoria. Mm-hmm. But I managed to get there.
What was the battle?
The battle was that there was obstructions, interesting obstructions. And people have told me about this. They said, look, you will find there is, the adversary will be battling a way to stop you going there. But I had, there was a strong instinct that I had to do some work for the people, for my descendants, like my people were trying to get me to go. And I said, well, I've got to go. And it came up that there was one example, and I've got to tell you this. It was just as an attempt to get to the temple. I said, well, I need my records. And the person, a very probably dedicated person, but quite out of touch, said, and it was one of the counselors, believe it or not, to the bishop. He said, no, he said, you're never going to get there. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, he said, we're not, your records are not going to be coming here anyway because you're out of the zone. He gave a lot of trivia. And I said, well, I've got to get temple trained. I've got to go to the temple. Well, he said, it's not going to happen. So I decided at that stage that I was leaving the church and never going back this time. This is a typical example of people who go inactive and for some trivia. I got to the door as I was going to leave. It was winter, so I had my top coat on. And the same voice said, speak to the bishop. And I went, what? My mind went, and I'm just pushing the door open, and I decided to step back, and I turned around, and I passed this very same person who was very willing to let me walk out the door. And he said, well, did you forget something? I said, no. I said, I'm going to see the bishop. And he said, well, that's okay. See the bishop if you like, but you know, you're going to have to wait a while. And I walked by him. I kept my coat on, and I sat outside the bishop's office, not too long. I went in. I said, you know, bishop, I said, I've got a problem. Da, 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 da. I explained the situation. I'm trying to get to the temple. He said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, my records are not coming here. I've been told. I've been waiting for them for 6 months. And he said, I'll have your records here in 5 minutes.
Wow.
He said, and there's the stuff you need to learn about the temple. Mm-hmm. And from then on, it took off. But if I'd have taken the words of anyone, it's like anyone who's got a problem who says, well, this is the reason why I'm inactive because this isn't this. Well, speak to someone else. Speak to someone else. If you're not getting the results, speak to someone else because you're God's child and you can get all the blessings, all the guidance that you need from that direction. So I managed to get to the Seattle Temple. I got all my stuff going. I got my garments.
How was that experience for you?
It was a massive. It was the biggest change that I've ever experienced in my life because I knew then that I had a powerful direction that I could hold on to that belonged to no one else but me. It was my relationship with a powerful God who guides us if we ask for it. But we've got to make an attempt to move our feet and you know, be deep down wanting to be a part of God's children, because we've inherited that right. So all we got to do is make it happen, and to make it happen you go in the direction. So that's what I did, and every time I was struggling I would turn and say, look, okay, at one stage I'd been inactive, and I have to say this because I was inactive, and I said to God, I had a little attic in my house. I was divorced then in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I said to God, I said, look, you can have everything I've got, everything. You can take my life. This is the truest words. I said, on one condition. And it was almost like I was giving God an automation. I said, on one condition, you must guide me. So when I sold this house and I had my truck and trailer, I had a little travel trailer, and I thought, I'm going traveling all around Canada. And I had a little dog, a little English Springer Spaniel. And so I go down to Victoria. I said to my son, look, Jace, I said, I'm going traveling across Canada. Got my truck, got everything I need. That's the end of it. He said, well, Dad, why don't you? He said, why? He said, why don't you, before Alzheimer's kicks in, why don't you work here for a while, a year, and then decide to go? So I said, okay, I'll do that. Yeah, okay. But I said, I didn't want to delay my plans. So I took up ballroom dancing. I'm waiting in Victoria on the front, watching the ocean, and two elders come along. And they say, do you know anything about the church, the LDS church? And I went, yeah, I do. Well, we've got, you can come to our church, and it starts at, I think it was 9 o'clock or something. And I said, yeah, okay, yeah, good. And, you'll be welcome. And I said, yeah, okay. And as they were walking away, I was saying, yeah, right, I'm going to church, because it was so far from my mind. But don't forget, I'd already made a covenant, a pledge.
Right.
That said, these are the conditions. So the next Sunday, and I'm living a little way out of Victoria, I'm finding myself getting dressed to go to church. I get dressed and to convince myself that this was not in stone. You stay for the first session and then you sneak out. You make sure you're in a position the way you can get to the door. Well, I get there, the first session starts going through, and then a couple of people from the high priest cornered me as I was getting to the door. And one of them went, who I'm going to see tonight, actually, he's coming from Canada, Brother Smith, Earl Smith, Earl and Mona Smith. And he said, I need to talk to you. And I'm thinking, he doesn't know I'm heading for the door. It would look like I was, you know, everyone's moving out. So, you know, the first session's over. He said, we need you in the high priest. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we need you. So another one grabbed me, and it was almost like what do they call that when group
being escort, like
no it's
when you're bombarded by
there's a word for it anyway. It was like I want to say an it's a very powerful thing. Anyway, they ganged up on me, got me into it, so I went through everything I needed to do, and it was brilliant. I mean, it was one thing after another as it went on, and then I found myself on a totally different path. The path that I'd chosen, it was like saying, and I remember this saying, if you want to give God a good laugh, tell him your plans.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this was it. And so then I got on the internet and I said, I'd like to meet someone who's got a temple recommend. And I got all people saying, well, I'm temple worthy, but I don't have a recommend. And eventually my wife, Dawn Ashton, who came online, and she had high credentials, and I said, that's never going to fly. But I was coming.
A woman with high credentials would never fly. Huh?
Well, it would never fly because my education was way low. I mean, it was, I just put in my bio just a carpenter, which is what I am and considered to be. But she said, well, I'd like to meet. I said, well, as it happens, I was going down to Salt Lake for a conference.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm.
And I said, so I'm going to rent a car and stuff. And, no, you don't rent a car. I've got a car and we'll drive. So I thought, well, we've never met. But we were on the phone for 150 hours from Canada getting to know each other. So I kind of knew her more than I knew anyone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And she knew me. And I told her all the stuff. I told her not every graphic detail of this, but I said, yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on in London when I left. Mm-hmm. I've never been back. And so
boy, good for her.
Yeah
she played it, and I thought, well, this can't work. I said, she's too educated. I could, because all her bio said it's got to be someone with high, like almost like PhDs and stuff like this. What I didn't know on the LDS Mingles is when you go on someone's site, they're signaled that you were looking at that site.
Oh, sure.
So she, yeah. I didn't know all this, but she flashed to my site, and I thought, well, I've just been on her. What's she doing on my site? I didn't know that there was, that's right, how the system ran. And then she looked, and then she said, well, I'd like to email you. And I thought, well, she knows who I am. I don't know. What's, if it could fly. And it did. And that was, we got married in the Tempanokas Temple on the, I'm going to get killed for this one. on the 14th of February. Oh, I'm not going to forget that
one.
Yeah,
don't forget that.
2006. Seven.
Seven.
I hope I'm right. Yeah, we'll I'm go, dead if I'm not.
Yeah, we'll I'll go call, back and edit I'll, that and if it's...
I'll text her right now and see if that's the right date.
So you come down for the conference, and then it's like...
Well, then she picks me up at the airport and says, well, my niece has got a nice house not far from me. Why don't you stay there and we could drive in together? Oh, she'd ask me, please, could I get her some tickets to the conference, because she couldn't get them there. I said, well, that's fine. So I got all the tickets we needed for her and my priesthood stuff and everything. So, and from then on, I mean, we just bombed away. There's a lot of stuff in there. I mean, she goes to China, just, we get engaged. Then she says, oh, I've got this calling to go to in the Peace Corps to China. So I go, I'm working in Canada. I'm trying to get to China. I go there a couple of times. She has a back problem. She has to be medevaced out of China.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's a ton of filling stuff. I mean, I'm just going to... the hours, you'd need a lot of hours
so
to cover some of this stuff.
So that was about 6 years ago now. 2 years ago, you are contacted on Facebook.
Yes.
So let's go there.
Let's go there. And then I've covered some of it in terms of... I'm in Canada helping my son out. He's fixing up a house he's going to move into. I'm living in the house while I'm working with him, fixing it up. I open my laptop, and I see on Facebook, on my emails, Facebook, David Thiel wants to be a friend to Bobby. And I'm going, no one's used that name in years. I mean, so I sent an email back, and I said, what's your middle name? Where were you born? And he sends an email back, and he says, shut up, I'm your brother. And from then on, my floodgates opened, and the whole of the 1960s flashed back through my system. I was bawling my eyes out. My son came in, Jason, and he said, what's wrong, Dad? And I said, I've just got an email from my brother in London. I said, no, I've got to get back to London. And he said, well, what's wrong with that? I said, well, they're probably going to be waiting for me on the border and Scotland Yard. I've got to go through that again because I'd never trusted them. But he said, Dad, he said, don't be silly. He said, 40-odd years? Who cares? Not a sort of, well, I wasn't far wrong. They weren't there, but there was a lot of interest in the fact that I'd been gone for 40-odd years.
Right.
So I got in touch with my brother on the Sundays. Every Sunday I'd Skype my brother Alfie, and David would be there, and he'd be talking about stuff, and he'd be in tears, and I'd be in tears. And
do you remember what the first thing they asked you was?
Yeah, like, are you well? Because Alfie, and it says it in the book, Alfie nearly died. And he had something wrong with one of his lungs, and they were going to take his lung out. And they did take his lung out. But David, my mum and dad had died. Part of the family weren't talking to anyone. There was a bit of a feud going on in the family. So David was up at the hospital trying to pull Alfie through. Alfie turned around and said he signed all his the medical stuff, take what you want, anything you can use. Body-wise, he'd signed it all away because he wasn't coming out of it. And David was determined, hanging on to him, telling Alfie, don't go because you're the only one I've got left. Bobby's dead. Everyone's gone. And we can't make it. I won't make it. So Alfie pulled out of that. Actually, some of that might be in the book. It is. But anyway, so he pulled Alfie through, but when my mum was dying, she was asking for me, and she said this, and Alfie brilliantly lied to her, and he said mum, she was going in and out of dementia, and he said, mum, we found Bobby. I totally fabricated. Mm-hmm. She said, oh, lovely, and he's on his way. And this was like amazing, because it wasn't a few years after that I showed up. So that's the reason I think he asked, are you well? Because and I was pretty fit. I mean, I am pretty fit. Mm-hmm. But so then I decided I'd had to get over there. And Dawn, I just got a job with JetBlue. And mm-hmm. There's a whole area that goes on there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how far to go here because I could speak for hours and hours and hours.
Well, let's ask you this. We ask everyone who comes in the Cultural Hall a few questions. First of all, do you have a calling at this point? And if so, what is it?
Well, I don't know. Because I've been back and forth to London, it's made it very difficult to actually get, apart from my home teaching calling, to get anything solid enough. I mean, I was there last time for 3 months. I came back about 2 weeks ago, as you know. And before that, I was there for like a month here and 3 weeks there. And so I've been back 7 times in 2 years. So, and working on the book. And recently, of course, the 3 months was because the book was doing pretty good as it hit. So,
you actually are a family history consultant, though.
Oh, right? Absolutely. If that
counts,
yes,
don't forget
absolutely.
The family history.
No.
We can't do that.
No, we can't. I forgot all about, like, I knew it, but I was thinking I'm not sufficiently available to be active enough that I need to be.
Right. But yes.
If you could pick a calling, what would you pick? You could pick any calling or invent a calling or whatever. What calling would you pick for yourself?
I think I would pick bringing back the inactive people who at one time totally committed themselves, because I find it, with the wisdom I've learned over the years, not to take any, and it's not trivia to people, it's very serious. They get someone say something about something or someone, and they become inactive. I think those are the people I would go for, because that may be an invented calling, I don't know. But I do know that, I hate to say it, but I know they're wrong by not being active. And the idea is to bring them back slowly, not full blast, because some people have got so deeply in their mind that that's the reason they quit and they'll never go back. But they should just try it again. And in a different frame of mind and with different circumstances, they'll find the benefits are amazing. If they'll only try it like I did, I'm going for one part. I'm going for the sacrament. That's it. And then keep going. But it's all about habit. And if you get into the habit of saying, I'm not going. And it's proven with many psychologists and many medical people have said, like, if you say to yourself, I'm sick enough times, guess what? You could be very healthy, but you'll be sick. Mm-hmm. It's all the state that you use, your own. And there's so much to learn. Every time I go in the high priest or in our history or genealogy, anything we're doing, from the testimonies, even though some of them are not, they don't really turn you on fantastically, but some do. So you've got to look for the pieces that will make you feel you're progressing, and you are progressing, and to me that's the direction, because there's so many people who I've spoke to, and I've listened to their story. Why are you inactive? Why are you not active in church? Well, because of this, this, and this. And I go, I don't say it to them. I think, oh my God, that's so trivial.
Yeah.
You know, the bishop's wife called me a whatever, or someone said something. And yet, you've got to go over. And I think the parts, there's two parts that are very important. In all thy ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct thy path. And the other one is, trust in the Lord with all thy heart, and lean not to thy own understanding. This own understanding is given as, well, I must be right. Well, hold it. What do you mean you must be right? I told God that I'm going this way, and you've got to help me, but you tell me where I should go. And he gets me going the opposite way. When I'm leaving England, exact same thing. Get on the train. But you've got no money. Get on anyway. And I'm on the train, and I'm crying, and I'm heading to Dover to go into France with a measly amount of money and a sleeping bag, leaving my family for what appears to me to be forever. And I can't believe I'm doing it, but still, I had to leave. It was so important I left, and without leaving, kind of other stuff.
What's your favorite part of your faith?
The spiritual, to me, the spiritual guidance that's always been constant. But you have to open to it. You can't block it. You can't say, yeah, well, I want to do this. You're saying to do that. And I don't think so. It's like choices again. But I think the temple plays a key role, even though I know very little that I can say, I'm nowhere near an authority. I know very little. But I do know that if you keep going, like I started going a bit more. And like first session in the morning, and I'm not boasting, but it's the most beautiful feeling, because you're up at 5, you're there at 5:30, the doors open, at 6 o'clock the first session starts, and you're in there, and you're going, okay, you get to the celestial room, you do all the ordinances, and you're now talking in an area that's the most powerful. Before I went to London this last time for 3 months, I went to the temple for 5 solid days, first session, because I desperately needed guidance. When I got back, I went only a couple of times thanking for that guidance, because inwardly I felt like it was, I appreciated it. It reminded me of the 10 who were killed and one came back. Like I felt very, I appreciate everything that I get from my church, from my guidance. But you got to keep going in. You know, the church will guide you. The Mormon church, the LDS people, every one of our prophet are all there for one reason, guidance. And if you don't look at that, if you say, oh yeah, but I have to pay 10%, 10%? 10% to get 110% is not a bad investment.
Right.
And that's what people go, well, yeah, what about this and what about that? And I've had challenges in England where I told not too many people that about this, but I told my brother and he said, well, tell me more about it. And it was just like an investigation without me pounding on them or Bible thumping. I was trying to make it like, you know, there's this tremendous power available to you. All you got to do is open up to it.
Bobby, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is called Bringing Down the Craze. It's available online, right? Yeah, if you want to get it here in the States, you have to get it online.
I think, yeah, you have to get it on Amazon. But you can send to England for it, and some people have done that. But.
Well, we hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body.
And when the time comes, you will travel home safely.
And if you weren't able to listen to the podcast this week, that you will be healthy enough to listen to the podcast next week. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you.
On the back row
of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat. On the back row, we really gotta go on the Cultural Hall show.